Running a small business is hard. You wear all of the hats. You lead the company, you're doing the sales, you're doing the operations, you're doing the HR, you're doing the IT. Do you really know all of the things you should be doing for your IT? Are you wasting time trying to solve problems that could be solved much quicker by someone who's an expert in that field? Get in touch with the team at Little Big Tech. We can cover all of your needs, make sure that you have appropriate cybersecurity in place, that all your data's backed up, that your team are all able to work whenever and wherever they need to work. Go to www.littlebigtech.co.uk and get in touch. The team would love to help you out. Today, I'm joined by Johnny Ball. Johnny has had a military career taking him from the infantry to the intelligence corps, has been through injury and recovery, and has also been heavily involved in politics. Johnny now runs Campaign Force, enabling veterans to get started in politics. Hi, Johnny. Thanks very much for coming down today. Great to have you on the podcast.
Do you know what? It's just good to finally meet you face to face. I've seen you kicking about social media and obviously listening to the podcast. So absolute pleasure to be part of this project.
Let's start the story with young Johnny. He's thinking about what to do and ends up going to the army. So how did that all come about?
Yeah, I think for me, it was always an inevitable outcome because my grandfather was a huge influence on me growing up. And his influence, in fact, made me join the Army Cadets. And it was really in the Army Cadets that I got a passion for military life when it came to things such as, you know, military turnout, bearing, shooting, but also the power of friendships. That was my kind of first taste of that, those real unique communities that we enjoy in the Armed Forces community. So time eventually came at the age of 17, I joined my local infantry regiment, the Princess Wales Royal Regiment, went on my first tour at 18 to Northern Ireland, and that was at the time of the Good Friday Agreement. So as an 18-year-old lad, completely wet behind the ears on the streets of West Belfast, that was quite the reckoning. But my military career didn't exactly go smoothly. Because I went off to university in the hope of chasing a commission and was in the officer training corps, did Cambrian patrol and all that Keno stuff that we did back then. I was fit. I thought it was my destiny to be an infantry officer. And I got to the regular commissions board. And not only did I fail the regular commissions board, having done really well at the pre-boarding, I had the flu and I shouldn't have gone really. But the most important dynamic with that, because I could resat it, was that I actually failed the medical for having psoriasis. And that was really the introduction to having medical setbacks, which has affected me throughout my career. But be careful what you wish for, because I then rejoined the Army Reserves at the age of 28. And then you end up somewhere hot and sandy, of course.
Let's just expand on that journey a little bit. So 17, you decided to join up and you joined the PWRR, yeah. And then from there you were going to go for the regular commission board,
yeah.
And that didn't pan out, and then you left after that?
I did, yeah. So after university I had to wave all my friends off to Sandhurst, and that was a real kick in the nuts, quite frankly. I was pretty lost, so I did the only thing I knew to do back then, which was run away. So I spent, my friends call it the wilderness years, rather affectionately. And that what that meant was that I went and skied and snowboarded for quite a few years, Canada, Val d'Isere. In the summers, I busied myself in places like Magaluf. I was even a holiday rep. At that time, that coincided with the whole post 9/11 generation. And I'm not going to lie to you, because I felt this overwhelming sense of guilt. I was having a great time, you know, summers in Spain, winters snowboarding in Val d'Isere. But I lost a friend, a school friend, Tom Tanswell, in Iraq. And a really good friend of mine, Lee Roberts, was badly injured in Afghanistan. So I returned to the UK and got involved in politics, which was a bit random. But I just wanted to serve. I was interested in politics, read politics at university, and I got involved in working behind the scenes of politics, working for members of parliament, running campaigns. And it was during that I thought, I've got to revisit this army thing. So at the age of 28, as I said, I re-enlisted into the intelligence corps. And when I tipped up and said to the medical, oh, I've got psoriasis, they were like, oh, don't worry, things have changed now. Off you go. So back to square one. Got another army number. So I am a veteran and I'm also a reservist. I've got two army numbers. One from being a veteran, my first army number in the PWRR, and the second one when I rejoined. So on my medals, I've actually got different cap badges and different army numbers on the edge of the medal. And that then escalated. Obviously, we were so busy at the time in Afghanistan, so I put my hand up and deployed for a 2.5 year full-time regular service, reserve service contract, and trained as a Pashto linguist for the inevitable place, which was Afghanistan.
What led the decision to go into the Pashto linguist?
There were two routes. So we had a presentation. One of my mates, Pete Dollamore, came and gave a presentation about his experience chasing pirates around the Gulf of Arabia with the Royal Marines as an Arabic linguist. And I thought, that looks mega. I'll have a bit of that. So I applied for the Arabic course and, of course, got Pashto because of Afghanistan. And when you learn Pashto, you're only going to go one place, and that is Afghanistan. So I was cool with that. That was kind of, I believe, our generation's calling, quite frankly, our generation of soldiers, sailors and airmen and women. So I had to step up for that. And I was fascinated by languages. I was fascinated by culture. I thought, having an infantry background, I thought it would advantage me. I knew that it would put me on the ground, close to people as a linguist. You've got to speak to Afghans. So I thought it would be really fascinating. I jumped at the chance. It was very difficult. I was pretty rubbish learning Pashto. I was very good at failing exams, but I was also very good at working hard. So I did a regain at evenings, getting extra time from our tutors, our amazing Afghan and Pakistani tutors who gave so much of their time towards us. And eventually when I did deploy, I had this notebook in my pocket and would go around Helmand and just point at things and say, what's that thing called? Da Sa Shi Day, I think is the Pashto, if I can remember rightly, 12 years on. I'd point to it and then I'd just write it down in my book. And that was the way I built up my vocab, but just this curiosity, yep. I think. So I had a really good tour, very interesting tour on Herrick 15.
15, so what year was that?
That was 2011, 2012. So the kind of threat at the time, obviously, IEDs were omnipresent. We lost Private Matt Thornton from the Yorkshire Regiment, who I was attached to on that tour. And I like to remember their names at any given opportunity such as this. I lost a classmate, Squadron Leader Ant Downing, who was killed again in an IED blast in Kabul, attached to UK Special Forces. And it became really real. And that was quite early on in the tour. So the IED threat became personal, just from the experiences of losing people that we actually knew. That refocuses the mind, right? Just as I did in Northern Ireland and had a really good mentor who refocused my mind about the threat on the streets of West Belfast, making it real. You're not a boy anymore. You're a soldier. That for me, it really, not that I needed waking up, but it really did refocus. That the ID threat was all around. So your skills and drills, looking after each other, and attached to the infantry on the ground. As a linguist, I also had the insight of the local population as well and building relationships. So I had a fascinating tour. And I even saw some mates that I served with in the PWRR as well, who are now WO2s, colour sergeants, all these years later.
You did the 2.5 year full-term reserve service. So did that take you on just the one tour of Afghan?
It did, but when I got back, I contributed to the sort of post-mission exploitation process. So I wrote some reports on how we can engage better in Afghanistan culturally, how we can engage with younger people, how we can use our reservists better on those kind of operations. And as a result of that, I got written up for a Commander Land Forces commendation in the Queen's Birthday Honours for my contributions to Afghanistan. And then service continued. So back into reservist life, and I still serve in the Army Reserves this day, just about, as my medical situation, which perhaps we'll come on to, impacts that service. But I've had a really good career since then. I've been an instructor at CHICSANS, our Defence School of Intelligence, and that was probably one of the highlights of my reservist career, actually mentoring and bringing on the next generation for future conflicts. Afghanistan's over. So how do we face future threats? What kind of people do we need? And having an inquisitive room of new intelligence corps reservists and officers as well, and I also taught on the sergeant's course, it was a fantastic privilege. So passing on the lessons, the knowledge, the experience to the next generation who have got to face future threats.
So you sort of dropped this full-time reserve service contract in the middle of a new career in politics.
Yeah.
So it was your degree subject took you into politics. And what were you doing in that as a job?
So I was an agent. So when I first started this, when I came back from Magaluf and Val d'Isère and applied for politics, I wanted to work for an MP. I was quite intrigued by it. I didn't know anyone in politics. I'm from a very working class family. We didn't know politicians. Wasn't a member of a political party. And in fact, the same week I applied for a job with the Conservatives and the Lib Dems. I wasn't particularly party political. I just knew I was really inquisitive around politics. Didn't get a reply back from the Lib Dems. So if you're listening out there, sorry, but that didn't happen. But I did get a reply from the Conservatives and embarked on a mentorship program, almost like an apprenticeship, and learnt how to run an MP's office locally, learnt how to run elections, sat election law exams, had a mentor. And this development piece and this mentorship gave me a real solid grounding to then go and campaign. So I've probably run the campaigns of about 600 local government councillors in my career. I have run European elections, police and crime commissioner elections, general elections. I've worked for secretaries of state, chairman of the Conservative Party, ministers. And it was that which really, a lot of that I actually drew from my military career. And when I got back from Afghanistan, I then went back to my old job. And everything that I'd learned in Afghanistan, understanding the human terrain, made me a better campaigner. Because you are in politics, you're understanding the human terrain. Albeit, you know, not while someone's trying to blow you up or shoot you. Depends on what part of the country you're in, but I used those transferable skills to the military and became a Conservative agent. That's now evolved. I'm now not party political at all, but continue to work in politics and run my own consultancy and my own not-for-profit, trying to get more people like us into public service, whether that's behind the scenes or, as I say, stand up and serve again if you're a veteran in elected office, from local government right through to parliament. And that's where I dedicate my life now, working cross-party.
So how did that work? So you'd started this career in politics and then you just took 2.5 years out. Was that relatively easy to do?
I was pretty fretters with it by the end of it, if I'm honest. So I actually mobilised on general election day of 2010. So I'd done all the work over the years to like that moment, right? And that led into a coalition government, and the rest is history. So I was there at Chilwell mobilising on general election day. And I was then focused. I was like, right, part politics, but actually being the result of political decisions as a soldier. So I do believe those in the military, we are actually political. We're very politically aware because we don't obviously question. We crack on and do the job, operations that we're tasked to do. But we're actually really in tune with the decisions that politicians make because we end up having to do them on their behalf. So it was a relatively easy transition back into the military. It was very comfortable. But the transition back from that full-time reserve service, I remember I sort of handed my pistol and my rifle in and then went on post-operational tour leave, and that was it. You know, I then had to find myself a job. So I toyed with all sorts of things. I was thinking about becoming an immigration officer at one stage at Heathrow, randomly. But then I went back to what I knew, which was politics. But even better, I had a really exciting opportunity working with Grant Shapps, who's a Secretary of State right now, really good campaigner, and absolutely loved it. And all of this, my wife does the same job. So when I was in Afghanistan, she was working for an MP. When I was at Beaconsfield learning language, she was working in Brussels in the European Parliament. So it's kind of in the family now. I just hope my wife doesn't follow our footsteps. Sorry, my little girl doesn't follow my wife's and our footsteps.
You've not campaigned for competing politicians in the same election, have you?
No, do you know what? That'd be really interesting, wouldn't it? We kind of share the same political views on a lot of things, and she supports my cross-party work, absolutely. I'm probably the most political I've ever been, but the least party political. I view the whole party political piece as just a vehicle. I just want people that care. And as long as they're not from, you know, representing a racist, homophobic, extreme party, then I will work with any of the mainstream parties to get veterans. Because every time I talk to veterans within the political parties, I'm in the right room every time. They just happen to have a membership card in their pocket that's a different colour to our oppos. But it's that human bridge of values and standards that make veterans such great politicians. And there's some great examples in our parliament right now. Johnny Mercer, our veterans minister, Dan Jarvis on the Labour side. We've even, there's a Lib Dem, Richard Ford as well. So they are there. About 50 MPs have a military background, and I obsessed with this. And that's why I started the Veterans in Politics podcast, to go and tell their stories. And this is global too. The youngest MP in Australia is an Afghan veteran. My friend Jody Mittick in Canada, double amputee, sniper, stood successfully for the local government in Canada. So they're out there. And if we tap into this strategic asset that we have, we can make our politics a better place beyond the Punch and Judy.
So Tom Tugendhat is my my local MP. And when he threw his hat in the ring for leader of the Conservative Party, which would have made him PM, I thought, wow, you could be amazing. And I was a bit gutted the way that went. He's an incredible guy.
I think he is. And yeah, you're lucky to, well, not lucky, you're fortunate to have Tom as your MP. I've interviewed Tom. He's from my cap badge, of course. And I really liked what he had to say during that campaign. There were some really progressive ideas. I think you also found people that weren't particularly political who were quite attracted to what he had to say. He started to ignite a bit of debate. I think people liked the way that he presented himself. And I know people in normal life who aren't political geeks like me were coming to me and saying, oh, do you know Tom Tugendhat? It's really interesting. And you know, my family were talking about him. And I think he ignited something really positive. And of course, front and centre of his campaign, as we learnt about him as a public figure, because a lot of people didn't know him, apart from you and me, and political geeks like me, didn't really know him, but they got to know him on the national TV. And I think they liked what they saw. And part of that pitch was his military background. And I think now that we're onto something there, because people trust the armed forces community by and large. Do they trust our politicians? I think that's waned over years. So they've got enormous potential to change our politics for good, cross-party.
Yeah, I'm still gutted about the Tom thing.
Let it go.
It was, yeah, I think we could have been in a better place now. So it's something that I've found that it seems to be common from people from the military background is having high levels of trust and trustability. And I'm guessing that's part of what makes someone like Tom attractive, and in general, veterans attractive as politicians.
I think so. But I think with that trust comes great responsibility. So again, I know, is that the Avengers I'm
no,
quoting there?
Spider-Man.
Sorry, mate. yeah. But with that does come great responsibility, because as that veteran brand, we are now taking that baton over from the Falklands War veterans who are now retiring. So the working age veterans in this country, whether it be in business or whether it be in public life, trust is something that is associated with our brand. So we mustn't mess that up. And I think we need to self-police that. Where we see poor behaviours in our veterans community, we need to call it out. And preferably not on Twitter, because it just gets in a tit for tat. But actually, face to face, and not accept those behaviours, because our values and our standards, by and large, 9 out of 10 veterans, I think, do command those values. And with that comes trust, because the brands that the UK public hold dear towards us, and that's been inherited from past generations. So from Falklands, Korea, National Service generation, Second World War generation, First World, keep going back and back through time. And that golden thread through there is things such as trust, because they trust us to keep them safe. So that's why I think if we tap into that, it's a strategic asset that we can make our politics, because people don't trust our politicians. I think 18% of our parliament at the moment started their political careers in politics, did nothing else. University, went for work for an MP, special advisor, then became politicians. People don't trust that. What have they done with their lives? We've just seen in the House of Lords, and people's relationship politics, every time they announce the Lords and all this cronyism, it just absolutely knocks us back in our mission to try and sell politics to the public. So I think our salespeople, our veterans, in our communities, in local government as well, is really important, because they do trust us. But I would say to the veterans, reservists, amongst us, don't muck it up, because that's a lot of responsibility to take with us on our brand too.
You've got great taste. You're listening to a great podcast brought to you by The Podcast Guys, one of the leading podcast production companies in the UK and US. We make podcasts for some of the world's leading brands. And if you're a brand owner and want to hear more, head to thepodcastguys.co.uk.
So I think one of the difficult things is it can be media portrayal of veterans, and it was part of why I wanted to start this podcast as a project was actually there's a lot of publicity around people leaving the military and having a really tough time, and that happens, there's people that need help, but that's nowhere near the whole story. There's, just from the guests I've had on here, there's people who've left the military and absolutely thrived. And then, like you say, the amount of veterans that you've worked with who've then gone on and made influence through becoming politicians, be it local or national. I thought it was important to get that story out there, because if you just left the narrative to what's in the media, then it just looks like people fall apart when they leave the military. And it's not the case.
That's why I do this, and that's why I do it very publicly. That's why I'm here now. Because we need to take responsibility for our brand. If we don't do it, others will. So there is a lot of responsibility, because a lot of veterans fall into the entitlement trap. And it's all too easy. The narrative, mad, bad, and sad. Lots of charities do kind of dine out on that in order to get fundraising. I can understand why. And the media, every time there's a veteran portrayed in the media, they're always bad. Every time there's someone that's done something bad and gets they're in the army 30 years ago, they'll say former soldier, and they did like 3 years, you know, back in 1981 or something. And it's a bit like, come on, that's not what. Why have you hooked onto the soldier narrative? So with that, we need to shine a light, and I commend you for the work you're doing here on that, as part of your core mission, because if we don't do it, others will do something the opposite. And it's really important that we continue to champion that narrative, and as ourselves, self-police, not fall into the trap. And people look at me, if they saw my CV, what's happened to me medically, you know, I have been diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety, depression. I've received treatment, CBT therapy twice, EMDR therapy once, and that's been provided by the government as well through Op Courage, which is an amazing mental health provision for veterans, and now reservists, because I helped change the policy on that. I've got lower limb deficiencies as a result of a traumatic incident on my motorcycle, not in Afghanistan. But if people saw that, the media, they would go, oh, you know, broken soldier. And well, no, actually, I don't accept that, because sometimes that when bad stuff happens to us all, trauma happens to us all, break up with your girlfriend, parents divorce, grandparents die, and trauma happens and crap happens to us, accidents happened. But it's how we respond to that, which is really critical. And take a responsibility with the offer of stuff available, like Op Courage, help me get better. But more so than that, it taught me about myself, and I've begun to thrive. I've become a social entrepreneur as a result of it, quite frankly, because I've got some skills. My resilience is far greater. My self-awareness is better. So I'm a better business person. On the paper, though, you can see the opposite narrative that someone could develop if they wanted to for their own devices. But I don't do that. I spin it around. And that's what we talk about, post-traumatic growth as a tool in which we can thrive. So that's my responsibility, though, and my responsibility to talk about that when I can. And that doesn't mean I'm ignoring the bad stuff. I've had some bad stuff and felt bad, but through community, through help, I'm coming out the other side really strong. So I can see the danger, and it comes back down to that brand veteran, which is why. But overwhelmingly, 9 out of 10, I'd say veterans are fantastic contributors to society, and we should be lording it up and championing them at every opportunity.
I became part of a veteran entrepreneurs group a year or so ago, and I was just blown away by some of the stuff that service leavers had got up to. And I'm constantly amazed whenever I go to the meetups of that group of the things that people are doing. Just incredible guys, which makes doing this really good fun. You just mentioned your motorbike accident. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because then I know where that leads. And that's a conversation we should have.
Yeah, sure. So I had possibly the loudest motorcycle in NATO. It was a Harley Davidson, big bad beast. I remember when I used to get it serviced, the Harley Davidson dealer would, he, you know, serviced thousands of these, said it's not the loudest, but it's up there. It just about passes, you know, the MOT and all the rest of it. But anyway, it was loud. I went on a routine trip to hospital for a checkup, and on the way there, I didn't make it. I made it about 2 miles into a 20-mile journey, got sideswiped by a car who failed to stop, give way. As a result of that, I saw it coming. I was conscious the whole time. I was hit from the side. My leg got in the way of the car and my motorcycle. I tumbled. My arm then got basically sucked into the rear of my motorcycle between the wheel and the mudguard or fender. So I actually be cut out of my motorcycle. I've never known anyone to be cut out of a motorcycle. Well, I did. I was in extreme pain from that pressure of my arm. My hand was saved by the fact that I had like knuckle duster Kevlar gloves on. I scraped a nerve in my arm. But the worst thing that happened was the impact caused a D-glove injury. So much like an IED strike, I lost all of the tissue muscle. I'd severed an artery. The bottom of my foot fell off. The sole basically went to the front of my foot. I just thought I'd broken my leg because I was stuck face down. And when I was eventually admitted to Coventry Hospital, UHCW, and the amazing care of Mr. David Wallace, they said it's far worse than you think it is. You could be facing an amputation, but you don't smoke. You're relatively fit. We can take bits from elsewhere in your body and make you a new foot, essentially. So they drilled two tent pegs into the bottom of my foot, reattached the sole of my foot, put it in a plastic bag. They took a quad from my right thigh, so I've now got a shrod, not a quad, stapled that lump of ham hock to my foot and created a new Frankenfoot. That was then put in a vacuum bag for the best part of a month. And over a month, I had four surgeries to save my foot. I had a further three surgeries to reshape it so I could actually get in footwear because I could only get in shorts because it was so fat. I could only get in a sandal because it was so fat. So they basically liposuctioned, cut, spliced, diced, remolded it. So that was over 4 years. I had an infection over lockdown. So I was back in threat of losing my leg, attached to a drip for 5 days, and then the mental health injury to contend with and starting a new business on my own. So I wasn't accessing furlough, lockdown, and had a new baby. So a lot came at once, quite frankly.
4 years from accident to being like sort of fully mobile again.
Yeah, 4 years. So a lot of physio. But the common factor for me, two things, community. So family, my wife, amazing wife, Lydia, my family, the armed forces community getting around me. And the second piece, which is sport. And how I access through CrossFit. I've got to mention CrossFit. Every CrossFitter has to mention CrossFit. I can't believe
I'm surprised it's taken that long.
So long, I know. Yeah. But
you're through, definitely not vegan because you'd have mentioned that first.
But through CrossFit, I access sport again. I was told you'd never snowboard again. You'd never, you know, you're not going to run again. Cycling, you might be able to. You can walk your dog. But my little furry dog, my little furry physio got me out on my feet again. And CrossFit, through surgeries, between surgeries, taught me about my posterior chain, how to hold myself, getting stronger. And of course, that's led to greater things that I'm facing now.
You've been doing a little bit of competing recently, haven't you?
I have, or just about to. So in line with that mental toughness and the mental resilience, I felt ready to put myself forward for the Invictus Games. And we had a series of pre-selection weekends. And as a result of that process, I'm very proud to say that I am the only serving reservist in a team of 59 competitors for Team UK for the Invictus Games in Dusseldorf. Through CrossFit, I fell in love again with weightlifting. So I'm doing powerlifting, which is bench press. I'm also doing rowing, the Vomit Comet. Otherwise known as the row machine, I'd avoid at all costs. I now absolutely love it. The coaching has been unbelievable. I've got, you know, people that have coached para athletes for GB for the Paralympics, and their coaching and guidance has made me fall in love with it. I'm actually the rowing captain this year, which is bonkers. And then the third sport, cycling, through community, peer-to-peer coaching, our amazing coaches, I've been able to get back on two wheels for the very first time in 4 years, having been petrified of getting back out on the road, because understandably, right?
Yeah.
But I used to cycle a lot. Yeah, raise money for charity, cycle rides, cycle every Saturday. The bike was on the wall of the garage. I was frightened. But through them, bit of work on track, coaching, community, I'm back on the road, which I never thought I'd do. It's different, don't get me wrong. I'm basically dressed like a Christmas tree when I get on the road. But back out on the road. And able to cycle my little girl as she's getting older.
Yeah, mentally, amazing. I would imagine that was a pretty tough thing to get over, like getting back on two wheels on the road.
It is. It's my medal. So I see how we go in the games in Dusseldorf, but the fact I'm on a bike again, that's my medal. I've won my medal. Told I wouldn't. I didn't think I would, personally. I doubted myself. And I've just fallen in love again, getting fit again. I put on a lot of weight, understandably, when I was pretty immobile. So getting me back again and my own appearance has been a big thing. Body dysmorphia, whatever you want to call it. In the early stage of my recovery, I've really struggled with how I looked, both in terms of the foot, how people perceived it, and how I perceived myself. So being fit again, the mental toughness is a non-negotiable now. It's a daily occurrence. And it's just made me give more energy. This morning I was in the gym, and I'm proud to say I'm in the gym most. I do rest, but I love it. And the community in CrossFit, people that have come around me. And since I've announced that I'm in the Invictus team, a lot of people didn't even know I was injured. They just saw a bloke that turns up at the gym. I was like, oh, right. So people don't perceive me as broken. Oh, right. They just see him as Johnny. Oh, right. Of course they do. Get over it.
Yeah. It was that whole thing, isn't there, that I can't remember what it's called, but might be like spotlight syndrome or something, where people think other people pay much more attention to them than they actually do, because most people are thinking mainly about themselves. But it's hard to believe that other people aren't thinking about you, because to yourself.
In a bad way, though. I thought people, people thought about me in a bad way. And when I was going through therapy, they even did a survey. My therapist asked friends, they described me about how I looked. And all they said was nice things about me. And I did the same. And all they said was nice things. But I just thought that they thought bad things about me, particularly my appearance. So that was a real game changer. But that was through therapy and guidance. And now it's a different spotlight. It's the spotlight of me representing our country, representing both the veterans and the reservist community as well. And I shouldn't shy away from that. But at the same time, I'm going to use that word again, responsibility. I see it as a great responsibility. So I talk to youth groups a lot. I go to cadet units and schools and talk about my injuries and talk about how you can actually thrive when stuff goes wrong, and it's going to happen to us all.
Yeah.
And I've had young people come up to me afterwards and share their own struggles. And it's a huge privilege, but it's also a responsibility to get that right. And I see that as part of the deal, part of the payback. So part of me could shy away. I've always been behind the scenes in either uniform or behind the scenes of politicians. But no, actually, I'm fronting it up. Deal with it. Deal with the moment, the spotlight, in a good way, in a positive way, but take responsibility and use it for good.
Own it. Yeah. Awesome. So three events. Is that normal, or do people just usually do one?
You've got to do at least one. You can do a maximum of four. And I thought three was enough. We've had all these pre-camps, been away most weekends. I'm in the gym every morning. So it's been a big commitment. So anyone that does think about doing this, you do need to talk to your family about the commitment, because it is big, but it's amazing. When you go away on these camps, they talk about the armed forces community being friends for life, this Invictus family, unbelievable. And like you say about the entrepreneurship, but the things people are doing, despite the fact they've had adversity, there's cancer survivors, there's people with MS, there's people with amputees. A mate of mine, Charlie, he's got a gym down in Blandford, CrossFit. He's got a great mullet as well, by the way.
Might check do a word out. Count on how many times you say CrossFit.
But he's got a great mullet, single leg amputee, and the guy's thriving in business, competing internationally. And also he's got his own business. And there's always someone that's worse off than you, right?
Yeah.
But as a community coming together, there's this unspokenness. We've been able to support each other through tough times on weekends. Life happens alongside all of this, and people have stuff going on in normal life. And that's a real privilege. So this community and part of this Invictus family extends beyond this games and to previous and future athletes as well. And I would, anyone thinking about it, do reach out to me. I'm the biggest advocate of this and it will stay with me forevermore.
So how many people go into the selection?
I think there's about 1,000 expressions of interest. And I think 300 or 400 people went on the pre-selection weekends.
Wow.
And then you put in an application. And when I put mine in, you do a video, 1 minute video. And I talk to people about storytelling all the time.
Did your own campaign for getting into the Invictus?
I was rubbish. I was rubbish. Do you know what? I was rubbish. When it's me, like my wife said, follow your own advice you give to other people. Because I did about 39 takes of a minute video. And then she came in, had a word, and said, just tell a story. So I told my story. I did it one take. Just, she, you know, got gripped me. And then there's like a couple of mini sort of tiny little essays you do about why you want to do it. And I remember getting the news. I was on a train from London back home to Northamptonshire, and it came through and you weren't allowed to tell anyone. There was an embargo for 3 weeks. I'm on a crowded train and I've had some of the best news I've ever received in my life on an email. We knew it was coming that day and I was on edge all day. And I just like a little yelp. I could tell my wife, obviously we were allowed to. And she, I got in and said, I can't believe I've been selected. She goes, I can. Of course you were going to get selected. You're ready. You worked really hard in the lead up to it and you're ready for it. Of course you were selected. I was like, well, when you put it like that way, yeah, of course I was selected. Yeah. So I'm very chuffed.
Awesome. And best of luck when you get there.
Thanks. Going to need a little bit of luck, but like everything, hard work as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So let's go back to your day job a little bit. A veteran, what's the right sort of person to be thinking, I want to go into politics? What should be the things that they're interested in, motivated by?
I'd probably say the person that doesn't want to go into politics is the best politician, the reluctant politician. But in all seriousness, that, as I say to people when they have that first call with me and I mentor them through it, and this is through my not-for-profit Campaign Force, I ask them 3 things, and I call it the N3 test. What's the thing near to you that you care about? What's the thing in the national news that you care about? And what is the thing that's never gone away that you care about? If they struggle to answer that, if they don't care about things that are on their doorstep, that's around them all the time on social media, on news at 10, or that stuck with them all the way through their life, if they can't answer that, then we need to ask further questions because they need to care about something. So forget all the party political nonsense, forget about policy and all this stuff. What do you actually care about? And I find the N3 test is a really good way. And then I'm able to then help them once they identify things, tell that story, because that's what they'll need to go forward for selections, whether it be local government or parliamentary selections as well. So I would say the type of person we need, to more diverse population. So I've already said that 50 out of the 650 have got military background. 2/3 of those are officers. Over 10% of those are ex-guards officers. So there's a lack of diversity in cap badges and rank ranges. I'd love to see more other ranks. We are yet to have a member of the Commonwealth or the Gurkha community as members of parliament. Why not? They need a voice too. They've served us. They settled here. Give them a voice too. And we also only have one woman that served in the regular armed forces, and that's Sarah Atherton MP, served in the Inc Corps, funny enough. Might have interviewed her once. But only one regular army female in, or armed forces female, in our politics. There's 3 in total. Penny Mordaunt did a bit of reserve service in the R&R, and Flick Drummond was in the Inc Corps TA. So only 3 have a military experience. And at local government, we simply have no idea how many veterans are serving in our local government, making the decisions that are close to us, our council tax budget, you know, our schools, our roads. So we need people that have gone back home, settled and gone, they look around and they see how mediocre a lot of people are in local government. So if not you, then it's still going to be them. And that's the motivations I've seen in a lot of really good veterans serving cross-party, whether it's Ryan McCready over in Northern Ireland or Andy Newman up in the Northeast, or Alex Lee down in the Southeast. They're 3 veterans I know funny enough, all three are other ranks, who got home and went, is this good enough for my family? What's going on here? And they stood up to serve again. So I would say, reluctant politicians, I want to speak to you. If those that I'm like, I thought about it, but no, it's not for me. And I look at them, I know you should be doing it. Reluctant ones, people that care, and a bit of diversity. It's not an officer sport, and I'm living proof of that. I'm not an officer, but I work at high levels within politics. And if not you, then it's going to be them.
I like that as an answer. That was, yeah. So there's a guy that I serve with in the Met Guards. He's a councillor in
Manchester.
Manchester, Paul Watson.
I know Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, me and Paul, we're in the Irish Guards together. I see a lot of his stuff on Facebook. He's very vocal.
He is, and he really cares.
Yeah.
So passionate. So I interviewed Paul only a couple of weeks ago.
Oh wow!
And I could have chatted to him all day. But he's uber local and he's an independent councillor as well, not party political, which is interesting. So it can be done locally. I think he's got a bit of a formula there, which I will share at some stage. But people like him, you know, very, very local, micro issues, he's all over it. And that's what it's all about. Politics is local. Everything in politics is local. And people like Paul completely get it.
Yeah, he seems to be all over all the issues that are very local to him, and obviously it's got him elected, and he seems to have a reasonable following.
Yeah, he's found a place, I think.
Yeah, it's good to see. If you were going to have a conversation with someone who was coming to the end of military service, and you wanted to give them some advice for preparing for a post-military life, what would your advice be?
It's that cliche, start early, isn't it? People do leave it too late, and we know that. But I would also say, you know, don't worry about the first step not being perfect, because the statistics are really high for those getting jobs within the first 6 to 12 months post-service. And that's for a reason. We've got good people. We've got good pathways. I'm doing some work at the moment with Mission Motorsport. And their work around Mission Automotive and Mission Renewable, pathways into different sectors. So these pathways exist. And guess what? Industry wants you. Why wouldn't they? You've got great human skills. I don't call them soft skills. I think that's really lazy. Human skills. You've also got great technical hard skills too, as well, depending on your background. They want you. So get over that. They do want you. Accept that. But also accept it might not be the first perfect move. The other thing I'd also appeal to veterans about, and this won't be a surprise for me to mention this, is think about what's running alongside your professional career and your family career. So, of course, you need to sort out your family. You need to sort out your money, your home, all the basics, kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and all that. But what about purpose? You cannot simply take someone out of a purpose-driven career and expect them to cut off an umbilical cord to a sense of purpose. It's not going to happen. And you can find your purpose in your community. I obviously want everyone to stand in local government as veterans to sort out local communities. That is option A. Come and speak to me. But other options, you might want to volunteer in your local scout troop or cadet unit or the local rotary or a charity. Find something that's going to scratch the purpose itch, because I think a lot of veterans will struggle for that very reason. Because they kind of find the 9-to-5 a little bit, just getting the money's great, brilliant money, brilliant. But what about the purpose bit that they missed? What about the community? So think about community as well, where you might find that. You might find that in a gym. I find it in a gym. It might be an Armed Forces Breakfast Club. But purpose and community.
I only just found out about those.
Yeah,
the Breakfast Club things. Weirdly, I was talking to a guy from Barclays.
Was that Andy?
It was, yeah.
Andy White.
Yeah.
Great bloke.
And it turns out he's now good muckers with another lad from the Irish Guards that I was friends with, who's just left and lives just up the road from me.
Their Breakfast Club's massive and brilliant and really diverse. It's a bit of a postcode lottery, depending, where I live, it's not for me, per se. But I find it in the gym. In the gym, I've got reservists and veterans and members of the blue light services. So I get that kind of banter there in a workout. But they have a place, absolutely. So I would say that when you are leaving, think about your community. Some people just want to leave it for a bit. That's fine. But if you want to return, I think Derek Hardman, the founder of that, calls it return to the tribe. If you want to return to the tribe later on, fair enough. But you can find it. And we need to reinvigorate our British Legions as well on a local basis.
So I definitely did the sort of leave it alone for a while. I left and there were a few friends that I still stayed in touch with, but I wasn't involved in anything that was veteran or military related whatsoever for some years. And then it's probably the last three or four that I was sort of drawn back to, well, hold on, there's this whole group of people that I've got a common background with, that, you know, we've got things like shared values, and it's been nice and fun sort of re-engaging with that. And I've had a couple of people that I've spoken to on this podcast who, it turns out, you know, we were in the same place at the same time during our careers, and you know, but like hadn't bumped into each other there, and it's been nice to re-engage.
That's okay though, to have a break.
Yeah.
And when I've spoken to international veterans, like Australian, I've interviewed two Australian veterans, Afghan veterans, never met them in my life. And there I am on a Zoom call, interviewing them for a podcast. And the connection, you can feel it across a Zoom call. The unspokenness, that's really quite powerful. So, yeah, if you want a break from it, but it's always there, it's not going to go away.
I had a guy on here, and we were in the same regiment at the same time, didn't know each other. We just sat down and chatted effortlessly.
Wasn't your RSM, was it?
No. He'd actually ended up as a company commander.
Oh, wow.
A guards officer, Dan Wilkinson. We were both Irish guards, same time as each other. And, but I didn't know him, but we knew all the same people. I had a great chat with him.
It's a real privilege. And as much as it's great to look backwards in terms of the military community, and we can all be, you know, pull up a sandbag and talk about Afghanistan, Northern Ireland, all the rest of it, you know, and sometimes we do. But actually, as a community, we're really forward looking. And I've seen the collaboration across the, this, for example, what you're doing here, the network. I was chatting to, you know, one of your guests before coming on today, and we're going to meet up for a coffee. That's looking forward,
yeah.
And that's through the armed forces community, sharing skills, trading together, collaborating. That's forward looking on the basis of looking back to our military past.
Yeah, I was out to dinner with a retired major general a couple of weeks ago.
As you do.
I didn't see that coming. And yeah, he's a fantastic guy, David Tathel. I think we're going to be doing some work together. And
amazing.
Yeah, it's just, I've met the most amazing people by reconnecting with my sort of military background. It's been incredible.
Yeah, it's a strategic asset, I think, is a phrase I've heard, and I've said it on this podcast already, but it is an amazing community to be part of, and a force for good.
I've really enjoyed having people come on and tell the stories of, like, you know, how great life can be post a career in the military. I mean, like, you know, Ben Legg, COO of Google Europe. I mean... he was an ex-engineers captain. You've got Paul Blair, got a distinguished service order for heroics in Afghanistan, then invented a dog toy and sold millions of dog toys. Now he's got a wearable tech product and amazing guy. There's just like story after story after story of these phenomenal humans. I have the privilege of sitting down and chatting to them for an hour.
It's amazing. And they're taking our brand with them as well. That what I mentioned earlier on. Our brand's in safe hands when it comes to people like that.
Yeah, I think so.
And for storytelling like this too.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy this as a project. It's fun to do. I mean, this is the first time we've met in person. We had a Teams chat, I think, a couple of months ago. And first time we've met, and it's been great talking to you today.
And where else do you get that? The Armed Forces community.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about how people can get in touch and what Campaign Force is all about?
Yeah, so with Campaign Force, you can find us at Campaign Force UK across all social media. I'm a bit of a pest on LinkedIn, so definitely find Johnny Ball on LinkedIn. Do reach out. I do have set up one-to-one free chats to talk to you about politics if it's the first time. We also have a monthly Campaign Force Connect event, a Zoom half hour drop in, no strings, to come and just find out, meet the community, the armed forces community that are in politics. And the other way, for those that want to follow the Invictus journey, there is the Instagram account at Johnny Invictus as well. So if you'd like to look at pictures of me in the gym and putting myself through lots of pain, then that's your place to go.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been really good to chat.
Pleasure's mine. Cheers, mate. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.